That's a story of the Inquisition. Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett as we're heading into another hour with Jonathan Kirsch. And we're a little ways away yet before we'll be taking your calls, but we are just talking about the way that the Inquisition operated in its various forms. Different countries conducted Inquisitions at different times and for different reasons, to get rid of one heretical group or another, or at least in the eyes of the church anyway. They thought they were doing this for the benefit of the recipient of the torture or the death, that this was a way of bringing people back into the good grace of God. We'll talk about how that blueprint stays with us into modern day. And is it really fair to say it's the Grand Inquisitor's Manual that we're still living with today? Why isn't it more accurate to say the Romans started the whole thing? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So Jonathan Kirsch was saying that in his book, The Grand Inquisitor's Manual, there's more to this than just how people were tortured. It was the why, it was the where, it was the when. So after the Cathars, then, who was the next group the Inquisition targeted?
Well, the other early group was the so-called Waldensians. They were also a kind of proto-Protestant group, believed in a simplified kind of Christianity, what they would argue was a purer and simpler form of Christianity. But once the Inquisition began to reach peak operating efficiency, it really never stopped looking for victims wherever it could find them. And there's another very important point that we should pause and focus on. The Inquisition was a self-sustaining machine for persecution. It took money and property from its victims. Once you were arrested by the Inquisition, everything you owned was subject to seizure. And so, as one victim of the Inquisition put it, it's a shame that the friars have to burn in order to eat. In other words, if they found a victim, it was a source of income for them. And that also prodded the Inquisition into looking for heresies wherever they could find them, and when they couldn't find them, to simply invent his heresies to persecute.
Well, it's the kind of the first order of every system is to maintain the system.
Exactly, and that's why that's why I call it a bureaucracy.
Right.
Because just as every government bureaucracy wants to maintain its existence, so did the Inquisition. And as a result, we have episodes in history where people were accused of heresies that simply did not exist. One very famous example is the so-called witch craze or witch panic. Women were accused of engaging in horrendous acts of satanic worship, none of which actually happened. There was a heresy called the Heresy of the Free Spirit, which was literally, virtually invented by the Inquisitors themselves. Now, later in history, much later in history, after the Protestant Reformation, the entire Protestant movement in Christianity was condemned as heretical. The Spanish Inquisition would arrest, torture, and burn a Protestant simply for being a Protestant. And the Spanish Inquisition also targeted Jews and Muslims who had converted to Catholicism and were suspected of secretly practicing their own faith. But these are just a few of the examples. You mentioned earlier in the Knights Templar, and when you're ready, we can dig into that example. The Knights Templar were accused of being heretics as well. It was just an excuse for seizing their treasure.
Well, yeah, let's hang on to that thought, and let's back up to just a second, and it may dovetail nicely back into the Knights Templar, but who were the stars of the Inquisition? We hear names bandied about, like Cardinal Richelieu and Torquemada, but who are the heavy hitters of the Inquisition? Who was really responsible for what?
Well, the Inquisition, as a bureaucratic organization, had a chief executive officer known as a Grand Inquisitor. The Grand Inquisitor oversaw the apparatus of the Inquisition, and in each national territory where the Inquisition was operating, there might be a different Grand Inquisitor. The name that is most famous is the one you've given, which is Torquemada. Cardinal Richelieu was not an Inquisitor, but Torquemada was the Grand Inquisitor of Spain. He, in a sense, invented the Spanish Inquisition, lobbied for it, and ran it. And that was the man at the top of the chain of command. But the work of the Inquisition was done by friars of the Dominican and Franciscan order. The history tells us that even at the time the Inquisition was in operation, the Dominicans came to be known as Domini Canes. It's a pun on the word Dominican, and it means the hounds of the Lord, suggesting that these were that these friars were set upon the enemies of the church, as you might set the dogs on an animal.
And so does Torquemada, does he deserve the reputation that he has?
We know most of all the Grand Inquisitors, we know the most about Torquemada. He supervised what was arguably the most ambitious and effective phase of the Inquisition, and he certainly is well deserving of his reputation as a bloodthirsty persecutor. He prevailed upon Ferdinand and Isabella, the king and queen of Spain, who we know as the monarchs who sent Columbus on his voyages of discovery, which resulted in the discovery of the New World and the creation of the American democracy in the fullness of time. I mean, Ferdinand and Isabella are famous for that, but Torquemada, who was the confessor to Queen Isabella, whispered in her ear that Spain needed its own Inquisition. The Inquisition was not active in Spain until Torquemada came up with the idea of getting a franchise from the Pope in Rome to set up and run an Inquisition in Spain. He managed to persuade the King and Queen of Spain to do so. They persuaded the Pope to grant them a franchise, and thus the Spanish Inquisition came into existence.
And up until that point, Spain had been relatively peaceful, kind of pluralistic society?
For long periods of history, Jews, Muslims, and Catholics coexisted in peace, harmony, and prosperity with each other in Spain. Now, during some of that period, political sovereignty was held by Muslim overlords. It was actually a Muslim kingdom. Ferdinand and Isabella famously evicted the Muslim kings and sovereigns from Spain and made it a Catholic country. And they decided that this peaceful coexistence among Jews, Christians, and Muslims could no longer be tolerated. And so in 1492, the same year that Columbus sailed for America, they issued an edict which said that anyone in Spain who was not Catholic had to either convert or leave. This was applied first to the Jews and later to the Muslims. And the chief work of the Inquisition was to make sure that all converted Catholics were in fact practicing Catholicism and not secretly practicing Judaism or Islam. And that's why a great many victims of the Spanish Inquisition were converted Jews and converted Muslims.
And interesting, so even though they could publicly convert, that still wouldn't satisfy the Inquisition. Does the Spanish Inquisition deserve its reputation as being the most vicious of the various waves of the Inquisition within the Church?
It does, and for a very specific reason, and I want to come into tight focus on this. Prior to the Spanish Inquisition, heresy was purely and simply a thought crime, as George Orwell describes it in 1984. It was the crime of holding the wrong thought in your head. And you could acquit yourself of this crime, this is so important, by renouncing the false belief. You didn't have to die at the stake if you were accused of heresy, so long as you confess that you had held this impermissible thought and you renounced it and repudiated it and embraced the Catholic dogma, if you did all of those things, you would not be put to death. You might still be punished, but you wouldn't be executed. The Spanish Inquisition had a terrible innovation, which suggested that if you had Jewish ancestry or Islamic ancestry, you could not truly be an earnest convert to Catholicism. So it was not the thought in your head that mattered, it was the blood in your veins. And obviously there's nothing you could do about that. Confessing was not enough. And that terrible innovation, turning heresy from a thought crime into a blood crime, was something new and terrible in the history of the Inquisition. And as I argue in my book, it prefigures the crimes of Nazi Germany in a direct and shocking way. The Nazis, too, regarded the wrong kind of blood in your veins as a crime for which death was the only suitable punishment. And that idea can be traced back not to the Inquisition in general, but to the Spanish Inquisition in particular.
The idea of you being killed as a way of saving your life, does that also not tie into this later to the Salem witch trials?
Sure. Well, being killed as a way of saving your soul, let's put
right.
it that way.
Your eternal life.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Your life after death.
Right.
It was the case that if you refused to confess and recant your heresy, you were an unrepentant heretic, you would be put to death. Up until the last moment before the flames extinguished your life, a priest would stand in front of you with a cross at the end of a long pole and hold that cross in front of your face as you were dying, in the hope that you would see the light before you died. Now, by then, of course, it would be too late to save your mortal life. But they earnestly, the inquisitors earnestly believed that if you renounced your sin in the last moments before you died, that at least your eternal soul would be saved.
But then, if you did recant, if you did admit that you had been a heretic or you'd been a witch or whatever, then you still didn't necessarily escape the flames.
Well, that's true, and I should pause and say that confession meant something very specific in the eyes of the Inquisition, and here's another example of what I call in my book the long shadow of the Inquisition. It was never enough, not in any phase of the Inquisition, including the Spanish Inquisition, it was never enough to say to the Inquisitors, I confess I was a heretic, I renounce my heresy. You had to show that you were earnest in your confession by naming names. You had to denounce and betray others who shared your heretical belief. Unless you named names, your confession was rejected and considered to be insincere. If you did make an earnest confession, what they deemed to be an earnest confession, you confess your own guilt of the thought crime of heresy, you named others, then in theory, your life would be spared. But there's a catch-22 at work there, too. If you confessed under torture, and then you later renounced your confession because it had been given under torture, you say, I didn't really mean any of those things, I only said them because you were torturing me, then you were once again an unrepentant heretic. And at that point, you could be sent to the stake.
And the long shadow of that, then, too, looms over both the Salem witch trials and then later, as we saw in the parallel of the Crucible by Arthur Miller, right?
Exactly.
That in the communist witch trials as well, so to speak.
Exactly right. In both of those unfortunate episodes in American history, and I pause to say that the Inquisition never operated in England, and it never operated, of course, in the United States or the colonies, the American colonies, although it did operate very extensively in Mexico and Central and South America. There was definitely an active Inquisition in the New World. But in the Salem witch trials, this principle of earnest confession was also embraced. If you were accused of witchcraft by some hysterical teenager, goaded into making these accusations by the prosecutor, you could only save your life by not only confessing that you yourself were a witch, but also naming names. And of course, that's the famous emblematic sign of the Hollywood blacklist and the McCarthy era, where it was simply insufficient to say, yes, I was a communist. You had to say who else you saw at the party meetings. Right. Otherwise, you would go to jail as well.
Even if the meetings had been 20 years previous.
Exactly right.
You had to remember all the people you saw there. So then, is that what separates the blueprint of the Grand Inquisitor's manual from, say, the original, perpetrators of the torture of Christians, the Romans?
Well, that's a very astute question, and I want to go back to it because it deserves a precise answer. And I'd like to mention another book I've written. My new book is The Grand Inquisitor's Manual, but I wrote a book called God Against the Gods, which contains the answer to your question. In the era of antiquity, when Christianity emerged in the Roman Empire and became a persecuted minority, the Roman Empire was not, I repeat, not persecuting people for their religious beliefs. You could believe in any god, any number of gods, any combination of gods, or no gods at all. The only thing that Rome required was that you showed respect to their gods, to the gods of the Imperial Roman Empire. Christians, as monotheists, and by the way, Jews as well, refused to make that gesture of respect to the Roman gods. They believed that there was only one true God and that no other God could be honored in any way by a true Christian. The Romans looked on this not only as a lack of respect, but as traitorous conduct. They felt that anyone who would not say a prayer in honor of the gods of Rome must be disloyal to Rome. To understand this, how this worked, I often invite people to think about the Pledge of Allegiance. We stand up in our schools and at ball games and at public events. We recite the Pledge of Allegiance. We say the words "under God." What we're really doing is making a gesture of civic virtue, of patriotic declaration. That's how the Romans saw the idea of offering prayer to the gods of the Roman Empire. Christians refused to do that, and so they were thought of as being traitorous, and they were, in fact, tortured and killed. What the Romans did not do, and the Inquisition did do, was to punish any form of religion other than the single approved form of religion. That's what makes the Inquisition different than the original persecutors of Christianity.
And I think that amplification of the thought crime, it sort of seems like that ties in there too. Well, let's go ahead then and let's take this break, but come back to the question of the Knights Templar, which we'll examine a little more closely.
Sure.
Yet another victim of the Inquisition, and then wrap it all up in a bow for us before we get to the top of the hour and we start taking questions on all the ways that you feel the Grand Inquisitor's Manual is still in play today, all the different ways that we have seen the Inquisition in its own way still in full effect in, say, the last 100 years of history. Next, with Jonathan Kirsch, the book is The Grand Inquisitor's Manual on Coast to Coast AM. And by the way, I put my blog up from earlier this evening. Keep forgetting to mention that. So if you missed crypto news earlier, the blog is up at coasttocoastam.com. All right, so it's Jonathan Kirsch who's hanging on here as we head into our last half hour without you, and then we'll get to more of your calls coming up after the top of the hour on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about the Grand Inquisitor's Manual and just how the Inquisition lives on through history, how it still affects us to this day. We'll get to that just after we talk a little bit more about the Knights Templar. And those of you listening last night on Coast to Coast heard George Norrie dare me to play the Inquisitor's song from the movie History of the World Part One, the Mel Brooks movie. And it is mentioned in his book. We'll talk about that. And yes, George Norrie, I'll take your challenge coming up after the top of the hour. If you don't know what we're talking about, you'll hear it on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So let's pick it up with the Knights Templar, because that's such an interesting example of the big money grab of the Inquisition, where there truly was what we would call today a conflict of interest that rendered the verdict on the Knights Templar at least muddied, if not impure. Jonathan Kirsch wrote the book, The Grand Inquisitor's Manual. So what about the Knights Templar, other than the fact that obviously they had overflowing coffers, what made them such a natural target of the Inquisition?
Well, they were both politically powerful and, as you've pointed out, extremely wealthy. And so they attracted the attention of monarchs really all over Europe, but especially the King of France, who coveted the money that was in the treasury of the Knights Templar, a great crusading order of the Catholic Church. Now, I use it in the story of the Templars in my book as an example of the danger that attends any religious authority which can be co-opted by a political authority. When church and state ally with each other, there's a very dangerous and powerful risk that their powers, their joint powers, will be abused. That's exactly what happened with the Knights Templar. King Philip of France in 1307 decided that he wanted the treasury of the Knights Templar, and he wanted to do away with the order because he felt that they were political rivals. So he prevailed upon the Pope in Rome to put the Inquisition at his disposal. He charged them with being heretics, accused them of being devil worshippers, and just for good measure, of engaging in all kinds of aberrant sexual orgies, and launched a kind of a dragnet all over Europe. It was the only time the Inquisition set foot in England, because inquisitors were sent to England to investigate and arrest Knights Templar in England. And the order was quite literally exterminated, extinguished. Its treasury was seized by the King of France, not by the Church. And the members of the Knights Templar were put to torture and made to confess the most preposterous acts of sexual excess, and then burned at the stake. Now, while I was writing my book in the summer of 2007, the Vatican released records that had been kept secret for 700 years.
Right.
A coincidence, in which they disclosed 700 years later that the Pope himself had looked into these charges and had acquitted the Templars of being heretics. But the King of France, with the Inquisition at his disposal, was able to condemn, torture, and burn them as heretics.
And in a way, the papacy didn't stand in the way, because it wasn't to their political advantage to suddenly side with the Templars, and or that there was money in it for them too.
It's true, and this was a weak Pope at a moment when the Church was divided and imperiled, and so the Pope did not feel he could stand. That particular Pope, Pope Clement, did not feel that he could stand up to the King of France. Later, the Pope in Rome didn't feel he could stand up to the King and Queen of Spain. And this is precisely why a religious court with the power to put people to death and expropriate their wealth is such a dangerous phenomenon, because if a civil authority, a willful king or prince, decides to hijack that authority and put it to his own uses, then whatever defense you might make of this church, of this bureaucracy, it falls away. It's simply a machinery for persecution, and it was used to eliminate a political rival and line the pockets of a particular king.
Now, is there a profit motive that ever comes up again in the, say, some of the other examples you talked about, the Salem witch trial or the communist witch hunt of the 50s. I certainly see the financial motive in Hitler's Germany, but has there been a consistent application of the profit motive throughout future inquisitions?
No, there hasn't. I make the argument in my book that there are certain features of the Inquisition that have been copied, that they provided a model that was so compelling that from time to time over the centuries, long after the Inquisition itself was out of existence, these tools and techniques were copied. The expropriation of wealth was not copied in Salem, and it was not copied during the Hollywood blacklist, although, as you have pointed out, it was copied very, very directly and explicitly in Nazi Germany and in Stalinist Russia.
Could we not make an argument that it was also there was a profit motive during World War II here in the United States with the internment of the Japanese Americans?
Well, that's another example, and I would concede that point to you. I point out in my book that the suspicion, and this is one of the features of the Inquisition. The Inquisition played on people's fears. It painted a picture of a vast conspiracy, a vast underground conspiracy that placed Christendom at risk and excited people's fear and even their paranoia about these heretics who could not be seen but were eating away at the fabric of Christendom. And they used that fear and anxiety to justify all kinds of excesses. Now, in World War II, tomorrow morning or this morning, I guess, in some parts of the country, we're celebrating Pearl Harbor Day or observing Pearl Harbor Day.
That was
a real attack on December 7th. That was a real threat. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But the panic response at the beginning of World War II was to take 110,000 men, women, and children of Japanese ancestry and put them behind barbed wire out of the fear that they would be saboteurs or traitors. That was a totally unfounded fear. We overreacted. And playing on people's fears to provoke these kinds of responses is another technique borrowed from the Inquisition. And I think, as you're pointing out, those families, Japanese American families, lost their homes, their businesses, their farms, their automobiles, their possessions, were forced to sell it at a fraction of their real value, or saw their property impounded. And certainly that was resembled the technique of the Inquisition to expropriate the wealth of its victims.
And in as much as there is always, or seems like there has been since the very, founding of this country, a kind of secular church related to our patriotism, that one is sort of throughout history given to God and country. But even in the United States, it seems like there are times when one can be persecuting somebody, say, like how the Japanese Americans were persecuted during World War II, even if it was, perceived as being something that that we had to do regardless of what we wanted to. I'm sure there are many more people out there that were enthusiastically, creating the economic conditions that led to these massive sell-offs by Japanese Americans before they went into the internment camps, much more gleefully than others, that it's sometimes hard to not see it as its own kind of religious inquisition. But it's just kind of done under the name of patriotism or God and country, as opposed to God and the church.
Well, I think that you've touched on a very important point, which is that there is a kind of a civic religion that we have embraced. Now, I would make the argument that the founding fathers of the American democracy certainly did not make that assertion. They believed earnestly in separation of church and state. And one of the reasons is that they saw the Inquisition as an example, as a worst case scenario of what can happen when there isn't a wall between church and state.
Sure.
But certainly it's true that as the decades and centuries passed, we have come to think of ourselves as a religiously based democracy. And I think an argument can be made, and I'm perfectly willing to be the one to make it, that everyone is safer, both religious people and non-religious people, and religious people of every religion are safer if we maintain a strict separation between church and state and avoid these kinds of excesses that took place in earlier eras and in the example that I've given from the history of the Inquisition.
Well, I agree. I've always, as a committed Christian, I say, when at the intersection of church and state, the church always loses. The church always comes out the worst for it, in my opinion. It may not immediately. It may think it's making some sort of short-term gain. But in the end, more damage is done by lending itself to a secular institution. Let's take this then a little bit further. If you go through all of the different ways that you think that we can still see some form of the Inquisition or the model that the Inquisition gave to humanity or inhumanity, as it were, that you still see afoot in the world today?
Well, I believe that the war on terror, which followed in the wake of 9/11, shows us that the danger of overreacting out of fear and panic and carrying out the kinds of excesses that the Inquisition also carried out is still present. Now, I'm quick to concede, as I did with the case of Pearl Harbor, that the people who attacked us on September 11th, 2001, were real enemies, and they committed real acts of violence, and those were real crimes. And we are in a war against terror. But the problem is that in the same way that we overreacted by imprisoning 110,000 innocent Japanese Americans who committed no crime at the time of their arrest or thereafter, we have had examples of overreaction in the war on terror. The most striking examples, we touched on it at the very beginning of our conversation, is that out of this terrible panic over the risk of another attack, prisoners in American custody were subjected to the same torture that the Inquisition used. We called it waterboarding. The Inquisition called it ordeal by water, but it's the same torture. America prided itself, has prided itself, and should continue to pride itself on rejecting torture, on upholding values that set us against torture. And yet, out of panic, we resorted to torture. That's an example, a very striking example of that long shadow of the Inquisition.
I just heard somebody defend those, what do they call them, aggressive interrogation techniques.
Harsh interrogation techniques.
Right.
That's a euphemism for torture.
Right. I just heard somebody defend that the other day and say that has made us safer because we have been able to get actionable information from these would-be terrorists through this process. And that reminded me of what you said earlier, when the church maintained only through torture could real truth be revealed.
Well, I want to say that everywhere I go to talk about my book, someone will say this to me. They'll say, we need to torture, or we have successfully tortured because of the imminent threat of terror, of another act of terrorism, and we've avoided it by using torture. And I would answer that question, first of all, by saying, I mean, I have to be honest and say I'm not an expert on interrogation techniques, and I'm not going to assert that I am. But I can tell you one thing or share one thing with you. What history has proven is that torture is an ineffective way to get actionable intelligence, because people will tell you anything to get the torture to stop. That's the whole point of torture. It's an excruciating experience. You want it to stop. You say what you have to say to get it to stop. You will tell any lie. You'll assent to any proposition that the torturer puts to you. Police agencies, police interrogators know that's not a good way to get actionable intelligence. It's unreliable intelligence. Now, for someone to assert that there are documented incidents where suspects have been tortured into revealing facts that prevented an act of terror, I am unaware of them. I am unaware that they've ever been reported. I don't think that's the case. I don't think there has been any actionable intelligence. And perhaps the best evidence of that is that of all the prisoners who've been sitting in Guantanamo for the last 7 years, there has been a single conviction, and that was not for terror, an act of terror. That was Osama bin Laden's driver.
Well, no less than an expert as Senator John McCain is would agree with you. He's as somebody who had been tortured said, you'll say anything. And then just as we see in the Inquisition, the inclination of the torturers is to not believe you.
Exactly. It's another catch 22. And
yeah.
So I think it's a false argument to say that there's ever a point where the application of torture is a necessary expedient. And beyond that, and this was John McCain's argument as well, our troops, our men in uniform, men and women in uniform, are placed at risk if we torture, because it only sanctions the use of torture against them.
The book is The Grand Inquisitor's Manual. So let me be very specific, Jonathan Kirsch, about the title. Let's talk about the manual itself. When was the Inquisition, the techniques, the modus operandi of the Inquisition, when was it codified?
The first legal document that sets the Inquisition into existence is enacted by the Fourth Lateran Council in the year 1215. That's the legal structure, the kind of the constitution of the Inquisition.
Right.
It is added to and refined by additional papal decrees over the years. But the manuals, which are very, very interesting documents, were standard operating procedures created in the 13th and early 14th century by working inquisitors and then circulated for the benefit and use of their fellow inquisitors. And this is the best evidence that the Inquisition was not just a hit or miss operation that operated differently in one place than another. These were standard operating procedures, lists of questions to be asked, legal forms, the exact language of imposing a sentence. All of those standard techniques were prescribed for the use of the inquisitors and remained in use remarkably over its entire existence, so that even late in the Spanish Inquisition, they were using the medieval inquisitor's manual.
I only give you about 30 seconds to answer this, but the Malleus Malefactorum, right, the famous book.
The Hammer of Witches.
The Hammer of Witches, that's part of the Inquisition?
The Inquisition persecuted witches, but not exclusively. The civil authority also persecuted witches, whereas heretics were persecuted only by the Inquisition. The Hammer of Witches, the document you've referred to by its Latin title, was a standard operating procedure, a manual for witch hunters, and was used by both inquisitors and by civil judges.
That'll hold for now. And we'll play the Inquisition song that George Norrie talked about last night. We'll talk about that, as well as take your calls coming up on Coast to Coast AM.